Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Greece and talk with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and professor of economics at Bard College. With Greece on the precipice of default that could unravel the Eurozone, we'll get an update on how soon the crunch will come and how the chips will fall. Then we'll speak with an expert on Yemen, Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Following recent mass shootings of street protesters, we will discuss the possibility of a civil war as the sons of the ailing dictator cling to power in defiance of the demands of the people. Then finally, on the eve of the execution of a man who many consider innocent, we will examine the case of Troy Davis, whose execution tomorrow at 4 p.m. local time seems all but inevitable, following the denial of clemency by the Georgia Pardons Board. Actor and activist Mike Farrell joins us. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus. Let's now go to Greece. Joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Subcouncil on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you are in Greece as we speak, and it feels in many ways that Greece is on the precipice when you have the head of the IMF warning that we could be facing a global recession or even depression. What is the problem? It seems to me that the overall problem here, and I guess to some extent is the same here in the United States, is that there seems to be an incredible gap between economic realities and political possibilities.
Well, I think the difficulty is that to recognize that Greece is not really a single problem. It's not only one country, but it is the whole Eurozone that it is in jeopardy. When you have all these bonds, Greek bonds that are outstanding, that they are denominated in a common currency, it is actually the responsibility, at least the investors believe, of the responsibility of the entire Eurozone. So when there is a teetering sort of decision about what to do and what not to do, markets do not like to see this kind of irrationality because the treatment is irrational. There are examples that the European Central Bank could look to its brethren in the United States, like the Federal Reserve, see that indeed if it were to assume or at least say that there is no difficulty with any of the bonds, whether these bonds are issued by the Greek government or the Italian government, or at least country, I should say, not government, or the Portugal or Ireland, they are actually denominated in a currency which the European Central Bank stands behind. Instead, there is a response that this is not a problem of the European Central Bank. It is a problem of individual countries. But that's not how the European project or the Euro project was actually conceived. It conceived first the Eurozone as a political union, and then the only way to bring it about, to make it economic union, it was the monetary union. Well, but that's an incomplete project. And dealing it as if, in fact, this is how it's going to be, it creates a problem for the entire Eurozone, and it cannot be isolated to Greece or even to the periphery.
But the problem, surely, Dimitri Papadimitriou, is that the Germans don't see it that way, at least the German public. They think they've got a choice when, in fact, they really don't have a choice. But obviously, Angela Merkel feels the political heat where the German population are quite angry at this situation. Now, of course, ironically, at least to my mind, what's happening here is that at the end of the day, it's not necessarily the Greek people who are being bailed out here. It is the German banks and the French banks. So,
absolutely.
So why
there
don't we have a little honesty here?
Billion euros that are being of Greek bonds that are being held in the balance sheets of the Greek of the German banks, and it's more than that in the French balance sheets of banks, and even some, not to the same extent, in the Netherlands. And in the rest of the European countries. So therefore, it's not a Greek problem. Now, I understand fully that the German people have been told that Greeks don't work very hard, they go to the beach a lot, they retire very early, they don't work as hard as the Germans do, and so on. And therefore, that clearly doesn't sit well if someone says that we will have to bail them out, and therefore we will have to work towards bailing them out. But, you know, this is actually a misunderstanding of what the Eurozone is all about. Those bonds are issued the same as the German bonds are. And what I said is that exactly the Federal Reserve has done to buy all these bonds, to, in some ways, for a different purpose, for quantitative easing, in Germany, the understanding is that the European Central Bank is supposed to do nothing but to maintain a price stability. And, you know, we have an individual who, unfortunately, forgive me, but he's not very smart. He raises interest rates. I'm talking actually about Jean-Claude Trichet, who raises interest rates thinking that, you know, inflation is around the corner. And now he sees that, in fact, GDP, even for Germany, is going to not show any growth for next year or for the rest of this year. So it's clearly a misunderstanding of what the situation is all about. And that doesn't help the German voter. And that's why we see that actually Angela Merkel doesn't stand very well and doesn't stand very well to get reelected. And we see that the changes in all countries, same problem might be actually with Sarkozy.
Again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He is in Greece as we speak, and we're talking about Greece at the precipice, given that some economists believe a default may be inevitable. And there also, by the way, a lot of economists seem to think that maybe a default is the better way out, and, you know, not just inevitable, but perhaps the better choice, given the mountain of debt.
What is absolutely clear is that Greece cannot actually service the debt that has been accumulating, will continue to accumulate in an economy that it is in the recession. It is accepted that this year the recession is going to show a negative GDP growth of close to 6%. A negative growth rate in 2012, and possibly even a zero growth in 2013. Well, while you're doing this, you need to service at least only to pay the interest of the outstanding debt equivalent to 8% of your GDP. So the dynamics of debt make it impossible for this level of debt to be serviced and to continue to accumulate until Greece becomes competitive to deal not only in the European markets but in the global markets. Therefore, the default is inevitable. It's only a matter of time, and I believe that it's going to happen much sooner than we think. And that's why I think that we see those cries from the IMF, as well as a plan B that it's being promoted from Germany, to have a default, but it is basically a controlled default. It's not something that it happens, you know, a disorderly manner, for which it creates a European crisis and perhaps an American crisis and a global crisis.
Now, would a controlled default mean that Greece would leave the Eurozone and go back to the drachma?
It doesn't necessarily mean that it will leave the Eurozone. What it would mean is that the recognition that Greece cannot actually pay that level of debt, and that will necessarily become a debt of, the European Financial Stability Facility or any other organization that the European Union will establish.
So what do you give the chances of this happening? Because it seems to me we're in the worst of all possible situations where Secretary of Treasury Timothy Guyton, who was just in Europe for the finance ministers meeting in Poland, he said that the problem has always been that the European political authorities have been behind the curve, and they seem to be behind the curve still. And, of course, the markets are acting fast and the politicians are acting slow. And at this point, what would you suggest is going to happen?
Well, the markets say that, the CDSs are trading at the level that they anticipate an 80% likelihood of a default, which means that if the markets believe that, what happens is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Even though in this particular case, the dynamics are such that the default is the only answer for Greece actually to get out of it. And the examples of Argentina and other countries actually show it. It doesn't mean that this is going to be good for Greece or for the Greek people, but it's not good for the Greek people what's happening now. The government is actually in panic. It doesn't know what to do. It suggests things in order to get the next installment, but those things it suggests, those measures, austerity measures that you will undertake, cannot actually be fulfilled.
Well,
so it's easy to just say that I would do, and I'm sure they have valiant efforts to do it, but it's not happening. You know, there's a huge the unemployment is rapidly accelerating. Businesses are closing. There are demonstrations in Greece. There is a civil unrest. Those kinds of things are really indications that continuing on this path, it's really going to ultimately be a catastrophe. So I think that the realization will come probably faster from Germany and from France, from the rest of the European Union countries, than actually from Greece.
Well, of course, we know that austerity doesn't work. It certainly is not working in England, and to a lesser degree, you've had signs or indications of the kind of rioting that you're talking about. We're obviously being forced into austerity over here by the Republicans in the debt ceiling deal from that hostage crisis. So there seems to be a global problem with economics where there is this dogma out there. In our case, it's the deficit dogma. And in the case of the Europeans, the part of this that I don't understand is that only the borrowers get punished, not the lenders. If the borrowers borrow more than they can pay back, obviously that's irresponsible and there's moral hazard involved. But why is it that when the lenders lend irresponsibly, they don't get punished? In fact, they get bailed out by the taxpayer.
You're absolutely correct. That is exactly what is happening. And the global economic crisis that was falling on us in 2007, and we're still enduring it to some extent, we haven't learned any lessons. And unfortunately, even economists in our profession haven't actually been able to understand that the difficulties are that you cannot deal with only the bankers that supposedly are too interconnected and therefore they're too big to fail, as opposed to thinking that households in total, they are too interconnected and are also too big to fail. But this requires spectacular leadership to understand on the political sphere. They are not Frank Roosevelt anymore, even though he also has some difficulties in coming to terms to be able to do what he did in terms of the New Deal. But those kinds of things are no longer possible. We see what's happening with President Obama. We see what's happening with the leaders in Europe. And you're quite correct. We're very eager to provide the stability to the banking system, but we couldn't care less about what happens to households. We couldn't care what happens to small businesses.
So, Dimitri Papadimitriou, again, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College, who is in Greece as we speak, and Greece is at the precipice. Dimitri just mentioned a moment ago that he feels that the default on the debt is inevitable. Give us a sense of the timeline and what you expect to be the reaction of the markets.
My suspicion is that, you know, the markets are looking for something, but they're not only focusing on Greece, they're focusing on Italy. As we all know, there was just a downgrade of some Italian banks. There have been a downgrade on some French banks. So the markets basically, if one sees them yesterday, the CDSs were 5,900 basis points above the German bonds for 5 years, for the Greek bonds. So we're talking about markets knowing that even though the European Union and the ECB might approve this next installment for Greece because of Greece's, of the government's promises to do all kinds of other things, the next installment is in December. I doubted that the government actually would be in power by the end of December to actually negotiate for the next installment of the rescue package.
So do you think that the Greek people will vote in?
I don't think the Greek people would vote back because, you know, the government has to declare elections. Right. But I think there's some disintegration from their own party.
Right.
They know that, you know, you can't always follow the leader if the leader actually has a path that it leads to nowhere.
Well, I was going to suggest that if they vote for the Conservatives who put the country in this hole, and with the help of Goldman Sachs who helped hide their sovereign debt, it somewhat reminds me of what could happen here in the United States, where the American people in their anger and confusion could in fact vote the Republicans in 2012, even though the Republican administration under George W. Bush largely caused the problem. So is there an analogy there?
No, absolutely, but I am not suggesting that that the results of the elections are going to be good. I think it will be terrible, because what might most likely happen is that a coalition government between the present socialist, so to speak, party and the conservative party, which of course is going to be a disaster. The point is there has to come from the European recognition that this kind of a rescue package that's been suggested for Greece and for Portugal and for Ireland and for Italy ultimately, because Italy has just passed an austerity package that the markets do not believe it will hold or that it's big enough. So therefore, I think that's why, as I said in the piece that I wrote, that the end game for Europe is very near.
And remind the audience again where they can get the piece that you wrote.
Well, it was just issued at the Huffington Post, but also it's at the Levy Economics Institute,
sure.
www.levy.org, and it's called End Game for the Euro.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dimitri Papadimitriou, and for giving us an account on the ground from Greece. It's very helpful.
The pleasure is mine.
Again, I've been speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified on a number of occasions in hearings of the Senate and the House of Representatives committees of the U.S. Congress and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitive Policy Council's Sub-Council on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the crisis in Yemen.
Each time I see you again,
ما تصميم خزران لو نجلس تجل ساد مزرو تونس
معتصمين
وسط الساحة لنعد للشعب افراحه محلى الشارع وصباحه عيش الفهمة والراحة.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is an associate professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula, as well as with the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Schmitz.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
And apparently there's been a ceasefire arranged in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, after government forces shelled a protest camp there, killing a lot of people. Of course, there was some bloodletting starting on Sunday with snipers shooting people and of course, shelling this camp. Apparently, this deal was negotiated with the Yemen's vice president, Mansour Hadi, and the U.S. and British ambassadors and others. So what are the forces arrayed here?
Well, the first thing that is important to note is that the fighting, though the shooting was aimed at protesters, there was really a conflict between the president, those forces that are still loyal to Abdullah Saleh, the president who is in Saudi Arabia, and those forces that have broken away. And those are significant forces that have broken away. The most important is the 1st Armored Brigade of Ali Muqsin. And the fighting, much of the fighting we saw was actually an exchange of fire, particularly on the second day, yesterday, between those forces rather than troops firing on the protesters, though that happened as well. The other thing that's important to note, the ceasefire, the reason we can have a ceasefire is because we have two parties firing. And so this is a ceasefire between these two sets of organized armed forces, which is important. That's important for stabilizing Yemen and getting a more stable solution to the crisis, in motion. But the other thing to say is that, in the past, since this began in February, every time that it appears that there's going to be a political settlement, suddenly there's bloodshed. And so this time, just before this happened, the Ali Abdullah Saleh authorized his vice president, the guy who's acting president inside Yemen, to negotiate for him in a settlement to hold elections. And then a day or two later, suddenly bloodshed breaks out. So clearly there's somebody inside the regime who does not want a settlement, and they're trying to scuttle it. I mean, that's been the pattern of the Yemeni crisis over the last, 8 months since the thing began.
So, Charles Schmitz, who would that somebody be? My understanding is that, and we've certainly seen a lot of this in the Arab world, since the Arab Spring began, you had the Tunisian dictator and his family were running a kind of, personal mafia-style government. We saw in Egypt that Mubarak and his sons, etc., family were administering a form of crony capitalism. And we've seen Gaddafi and his sons clearly a part of a kleptocratic dictatorship, and it sounds like Saleh and his sons, and that's just a repetition. And he's been there for, 33 years, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has been there for 33 years. Well, just a couple of things occur to me as you talk. Well, now, I do think that probably within the regime itself there are people who don't want a settlement that maybe the president himself does want. In other words, the president may be looking to sort of preserve his family's position in a general agreement within Yemen, whereas some members of the family want the whole pie. They want to retain the presidency and all this. Some members of the family may not be as far-sighted as the president sometimes is politically. The president can be quite astute politically. Then the other thing that strikes me is that, these forces, the organized forces that are the opposition forces, Ali Muqsin's forces, and the Al-Ahmar brothers, who are leaders of the Hashid Tribal Confederation, who are the opposition. And these guys are the elite of the opposition. These guys are the ones that are sort of heading up the possibility of an alternative government. They themselves, up until very recently, were the core of the regime. Ali Muhsin was in charge of repression in the regime. He was the key military guy in charge of maintaining the military power of the regime itself. And the Al-Ahmar brothers were core parts of the regime as well. So they're no less corrupt. They're no less a part of the system that the regime is than the president himself. So in some senses, this is there's a strong element of an inter-elite struggle. That's not to say that the protesters don't play a very important role. They do, and the protesters are changing sort of the discourse of Yemeni politics. So, you know, the idea that there is human rights and that the regime has to be much wider in its political participation, and that you know, the rule of law is important. These things the street is bringing and sort of forcing some of the old guard out, which is a good thing. But to a large extent, the Yemeni crisis is a crisis, inter-elite crisis, and that can't be overlooked.
So we assume, I suppose, given that President Saleh is in Saudi Arabia following the attack on the presidential compound in June, where he was fairly badly injured, he's being treated in Saudi Arabia. So presumably the Saudis are influencing him, as they do influence the country itself. And I take it that the U.S. and British ambassadors and others who are negotiating these deals, and these ceasefires, are negotiating with these other players, the defecting general, who was previously was the enforcer and now is the liberator. So no representation for the people, right? No, in this mix.
Well, yes and no. I mean, in a way, the conflict in Yemen has been over the elections, coming elections, and that would differentiate it from the rest of the Arabian Peninsula, where they're monarchies.
Mm-hmm.
In the conflict is really who is going to oversee the next set of elections. The president called for earlier elections earlier, but the opposition didn't want to play because the president wanted to retain control over the electoral process, and the opposition rejects that. And so, in a sense, the battle still is over electoral process, because what will come next, in some form or another, is a transitional government. And the transitional government will oversee the elections. It's the composition of that transitional government that everybody's fighting about. But in anybody's view, there will be new elections, and in that sense, the people will have some role. So we can't count the people out completely in Yemen. They have had a very important role in changing politics.
But it's apparently worth fighting over who controls the elections, because
yeah.
He who controls the elections rigged the elections, right?
Not necessarily rigging the elections. I mean, the way Yemen the elections have gone have been that there hasn't been that much ballot stuffing. The actual balloting process isn't where the influence is. The influence is rather controlling resources. So the government will come to a village and say, you know, let's hope the ruling party wins in the village, or this water project will never make it here. It's on that end that they can control it. And so, presumably, in the next elections, if it is pulled outside of the government into a truly transitional government that's run by the opposition, we may see quite free and fair elections this time in Yemen.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is a professor at Towson University and the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. So these battles that have been going on for several days now, apparently they moved into the upscale neighborhood of Sana'a, the Hadda neighborhood. Can you give us a picture of that? I mean, the idea of a civil war in Beverly Hills here in Los Angeles is something
well,
to grasp.
They call it the Hadda district. It's where, for example, all the embassy employees would live. It's where the foreigners would live. So, you know, all the UN folks and NGO folks and whatnot, they all would live out there. It's kind of the newer a newer suburb, and well off, better built than some of the other suburbs of Sana'a. And part of the reason that the battle went out there was that Hamid al-Ahmar, who's one of the key members of the al-Ahmar family and one who's been calling, who has aspirations for the presidency himself, and who has called for the president to step down from long before this began. He started calling for Ali Abdullah Saleh to leave, I think, in 2009. His house is out there, and that's what that fighting was about. So that was the target there. Actually, most of the big fighting happened more towards the center of the city when the protesters moved out of what had been sort of limited as their part of the city. They started to move out. And as soon as they started to move out, the shooting started from government troops that were around the area. The city is kind of divided into camps, where there's pro-government camps, and then there's protester camps, and then there's pro-government military areas, and then there's pro-opposition military areas, formal military areas and units and whatnot. And to get through the city, you have to go through multiple checkpoints as you go through this or that zone. And so the fighting started when they tried to shift some of those lines.
Well, apparently there's also been fightings and certainly killing by security forces in other cities such as Taiz and Aden.
Yes. Taiz has seen, well, Aden has seen it for a long time because they have been the Southerners have been carrying out a civil disobedience movement in the south, and Aden has basically been occupied by the security for a long time. But the other place where you see a big conflict is Taiz, where basically the city is divided between loyalists to the government and loyalists and forces of the loyal to the opposition. And there has been very serious fighting down there. Peace negotiations, it holds for a little while and then fighting again. But Taiz, yes, has seen a lot of fighting. And then there's a lot of fighting that happens in the far out regions as well. There's fighting in Arhab, which is actually a little not too far north of Sana'a. And those fights are fights between tribes, military units over bases. Those are strategic military fights usually. Mm-hmm. And there's been a number of those going on. And then there's the fight with Al-Qaeda happening down in Zanzibar. Zanzibar was just retaken recently, but there's still some other towns that are still occupied, and they're fighting down there. So there's quite a bit of fighting going on outside of Sana'a and the main cities as well.
Well, you just mentioned Charles Schmitt's Al-Qaeda. Now, of course, Al-Qaeda is always invoked by the 33-year-long dictator Saleh, who just like I mentioned the analogies earlier with the family rule with Mubarak and Gaddafi, etc., and the sons, and Saleh and his sons, they always invoke Al-Qaeda as being behind the opposition. Is that meant to play to the Americans' ears?
In Yemen, most people sort of see Al-Qaeda as as a tool of the government to get U.S. aid. And so the government, and the president does sort of present himself as the last front before Yemen falling to Al-Qaeda. But two things about that. One, Al-Qaeda is not going to take over Yemen, but Al-Qaeda does have a significant force in Yemen. And surprisingly, I was quite surprised by the fact that back in the early part of the summer, a group that allegedly is affiliated with them actually tried to control territory, which is not usually the strategy of Al-Qaeda, to control territory. And they took over a number of towns, and they held on to them, and they fought fiercely government forces down there. But as a result, they have become an open target, and quite a few of the top leadership has been killed, and they've suffered terrible losses with this strategy. To me, through their eyes, it was not a very strategic thing to do. And now they are losing in the south. So, Al-Qaeda remains in Yemen, remains operating in Yemen, but they've taken significant losses in this operation.
Well, isn't the U.S. presence there growing by the day? I mean, it's often referred to as the next front in the war on terror.
Yeah, I don't know that everybody's up to date. I mean, they often say Petraeus said in hearings before Congress that it's
the strongest branch of Al-Qaeda in the world right now, that the, you know, the Pakistani ones have been weakened significantly. But, you know, that may have been before the very recent military operations, because, you know, the advances that the group affiliated with Al-Qaeda made and held for quite some months, they've been reversed. So I'm not quite sure of that assessment, whether it still holds.
Well, we do hear a lot of about drone strikes. So there must be, even if the footprint is not that visible, the U.S. must have a substantial footprint there somewhere.
Oh, yes. Well, there is the African command is in Djibouti, just across there. And you know, I don't know the ranges of all these things, but it would be quite, you know, I'm sure they're working somewhat in conjunction with them.
Yes,
the U.S. has significant presence there. And, you know, this is the place where Obama is authorizing strikes, you know, basically targeted assassinations against lists of people who are considered top leaders inside of Yemen.
Yes, it's
going on.
So we're spending an enormous amount of money on the military, which we often do. And meanwhile, we're talking about Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world. A lot of analysts say it's already a failed state. It has 7.5 million of its population, one-third of its population, going hungry. So are we in any way conscious of that, or is our focus purely military? Because clearly there's
There are substantial political and sort of relief efforts that are going on, although the United States isn't that involved in the relief efforts. There was, when the group in the south, when the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group in the south took over those towns, there was very large refugee populations that left and went towards other areas, particularly Aden. And there have been relief efforts down there, not by the United States, but by international organizations. The United States was involved in relief efforts in the conflict in the north, in the Houthi conflict. The United States gave some relief there. The United States mostly sees its humanitarian efforts, though, and its relief efforts through the lens of the political ramifications of the humanitarian crisis. And so they want to contain any humanitarian crisis so it doesn't spill over into the already very volatile political situation. The United States wants most of all to see a political solution. They want to see elections. The U.S. ambassador has been very active on the ground in trying to pull together and negotiate some kind of a political settlement for the crisis, because in the immediate future, that's the most important thing, and the one that will facilitate relief of some of the other humanitarian crises that are going on.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Charles Schmitz.
You're quite welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. He's an associate professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. We're going to take a brief station break, and coming back, we'll be speaking with Mike Farrell about the death penalty facing Troy Davis in Georgia tomorrow.
Strapped across their shoulders, and then the kerosene is brought down from the castles by insurance men who go check to see that nobody is escaping to Desolation Row.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is actor Mike Farrell, who is best known for his 8 years on MASH and 5 seasons on Providence. He is also a writer, director, and producer of motion pictures such as Patch Adams. A social and political activist, Farrell has served on human rights and peace delegations and was co-chair of the Southern California Committee of Human Rights Watch from 1994 to 2004. He's the president of Death Penalty Focus since 1994. He has visited too many death rows and speaks, debates, writes, and coordinates efforts to stop executions across the country. He's the author of two books, Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist, and of Mule and Man. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Farrell.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be with you.
It's good to be with you. I wish it was under better circumstances because...
As do I.
Tomorrow at 7 p.m. in Georgia, which is 4 p.m. local time, it seems that Troy Davis will be administered a lethal cocktail of drugs following the rejection of a pardon by the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole, despite overwhelming evidence indicating that his conviction for murder is, shall we say, unreliable?
Well, unreliable would be good. You know, even the judge who effectively is responsible for turning down his last appeal said that was the case against him was not ironclad, which is an interesting interesting observation about a person you're sending to death. But, you know, it's been discussed all over the place that the seven of the nine prosecution witnesses have recanted, despite the fact that the district attorney says these recantations are false or somehow inappropriate. But there's no evidence other than the witnesses to tie Davis to this killing, and the witnesses who identified him as the killer, virtually to a person, say the ones that have recanted say that the police essentially forced them, coerced them, frightened them into naming Davis as the perpetrator of this crime. And two or three people have said that the one of the two remaining witnesses who insist that Davis is the one was in fact himself the perpetrator. So it's really an ugly case, and it has been so for so long. You know, the case of he was sent to death row in 1991, so we're now 20 years into this terrible legal dilemma. And the idea that the international community really has gotten up and looked at the case and said to the Georgia, the last most recent decision, Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, but they've said to the justice community in general in Georgia that this is simply untenable. They really have to find a way to either commute the man to life without parole so that his attorneys can continue to do work necessary to try to exonerate him, or do something. But to go forward in this situation is simply unacceptable, and I hope that I'm hoping that there's a way for it to be stopped. There are, as I understand it, there are a number of legislators in Georgia who have asked they've gone on record and asked the people in the prison to not show up tomorrow, to not allow them to do the work necessary to kill Troy Davis. And my organization, which is now run by a former warden of San Quentin, has put together half a dozen wardens and former wardens asking the warden of the prison in Georgia to not go forward with it. But you know, these are grasping at straws because the legal gauntlet has been run, unfortunately.
Well, Mike Farrell, just in terms of eyewitnesses recanting, apparently seven out of the nine key witnesses who implicated Troy Davis have recanted their evidence. Several have said that they were forced by the police into giving false statements. Now, but there's apparently another 10 have come forward to point the finger at the person that I think you alluded to, who was present at the scene of the murder, Sylvester Coles, and even though 10 people have said he's the suspect, and apparently there's actual direct testimony was given yesterday to the Board of Paroles and Pardons by Brenda Forrest, by Kiana Glover, who testified she had heard Coles confess in June 2009 of having been the killer.
Yes.
So this all fell on deaf ears? I mean, what explains that? Who were these people on the Board of Pardons? I saw a video clip, and without being too pejorative, they were mostly white male Protestants.
Well, yes, of course they're going to be mostly and probably unilaterally white males. I will tell you that Amnesty International alone got 600,000 signatures on a petition to them to stop the execution. And I signed, as many people did, different petitions from the NAACP, from Amnesty, from various organizations, and my own organization. But I began to wonder, given the nature of the kind of mindset in certain parts of the country, if this wasn't going to be ultimately a negative, that these people were going to say, you can't tell us what to do, you know, we have our own. There's a little, we discuss Texas a lot because Texas is the most, as we all know, the most active killing state. And there is a kind of culture in Texas that suggests that, you know, you don't tell us what to do. We're the people who know what we want to have and what we want to do. And I'm wondering if on some level the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles didn't respond in the same way.
Well, Mike Farrell, not only your organization, which you're president at the Death Penalty Focus, have been active in this, a number of prominent people have stepped forth, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former President Jimmy Carter, who, of course, is in Georgia, yeah. Former director of the FBI, William Sessions, 51 members of the United States Congress. There is a substantial movement afoot, and when you mentioned Texas, of course, Mike Farrell, we recently, of course, we saw the Texas governor running for president of the United States. Mm-hmm. In fact, the front runner on the Republican as the Republican nominee,
yes.
More or less, proudly proclaimed that he was an advocate of death penalty, and proudly said that in Texas, you know, we basically kill people.
Essentially, yes.
That's what he said. Now,
and you recall the audience's reaction to that whole ugly scenario where the questioner said you've been responsible for the death of 243 condemned prisoners, and they cheered.
Right. Well, they also cheered the other day, by the way, on a CNN debate organized by the Tea Party and CNN, where a hypothetical question about a young man not having insurance, would you pull the plug on him? And people in the audience said, yeah. So are we talking about a kind of a coarseness and cruelty that's creeping across the land?
I don't think there's any question about it, Ian. And I have to say that for some years now, I've been trying to talk to people about the death penalty and about the fact that it is, I believe, coarsening our society. It's practice. It's the use of the death penalty and the defense of the death penalty has been, I believe, undermining the moral fabric of this nation. And I think we're seeing some pretty grotesque demonstrations of the fact that the moral fabric of this nation is in very, very difficult straits.
And is this to do with a deteriorating economy or to do with there is a kind of in the red states, which are mostly and of course, well, let's just take the example of Rick Perry, since we were talking about him. Mm. He started his political campaign by appearing at a religious revival meeting, largely to point out that he wasn't a Mormon. I think that was the subtext. But he is definitely galvanizing the evangelicals. One of the things that I notice that's different between the evangelicals and the Catholics, even though they share the anti-abortion dogma, they are at opposite poles on, well, actually you could argue the Catholics are quite consistent in their sense of the right to life. They not only are against abortion, they're against capital punishment and killing in wars as well.
Yes.
No such exceptions are made on the other side. In fact, Perry, it looks like he's getting votes by proudly proclaiming that he'd be happy to pull the switch.
Yes, and in fact, you know, Perry's record, once it becomes fully known, is pretty ugly in terms of a couple of cases. One being Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed under Perry's governorship, and has been demonstrated to have been innocent. But Perry has done everything he can. He's turning political backflips to try to keep that news from actually being widely known.
Is that the house was burned down?
Yes.
There's an unbelievable amount of evidence of not just judicial misconduct, isn't there?
The whole thing. I mean, it is so incredibly unscrupulous what they've done and continue to do that I can't believe that once it finally becomes known that it won't sink him and his candidacy. But this is me being the hopeful,
sure.
The hopeful optimist, I suppose.
Well, but you know, if we were in Troy Davis's shoes, I mean, he, you know, we're talking about 4 o'clock tomorrow,
yes,
our time,
yes,
and he's run out of options, right? The Supreme Court probably won't touch it. They did actually allow which was, I think, unusual. They allowed the case to be reopened, but then it was quickly closed again by a federal judge.
It was.
And I don't understand this. I mean, I understand the testimony, the testimony yesterday from eyewitnesses who recanted and from the woman who I mentioned who was told by the fellow that's more likely to have done the murder, Sylvester Coles, her testimony. But the family of Officer Mark MacPhail seems to be the ones that they listened to. And now, would that suggest that there's a subtext here that since a policeman was shot, the kind of, you know, the law enforcement community kind of rally around and they've got political sway and nobody wants to buck that system?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. Quite often you find probably the most famous case in the country about a police officer being killed and the attempt on the part of the allied police forces around the country to see that he is executed is Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I don't think there's any question but that people, particularly law enforcement, see the killing of a law enforcement officer as different, as being the one reason that the death penalty is absolutely justified. And when you have that kind of attitude, that kind of community that is intent on seeking not just justice, but seeking revenge, insisting that a point be made that these cop killers, as they would have you believe, are somehow less than human. I'm sure what we saw in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case and what we now see in the Troy Davis case is a demonstration of that very thing, that the police officer, and nobody wants to see a police officer killed. I don't mean to suggest that the police officers should be gunned down. But what happens, it seems to me, is that there this need for kind of bloodlust and vengeance obscures people's vision. And once they focus on an individual who they determine is the perpetrator, everything else sort of is sloughed aside because of the need for having some kind of retribution take place in it. And it's a really, truly frightening thing.
Well, it's understandable, I would think, that the police would want to send a signal to the community that you don't kill us.
And, of course.
But that's a totally different thing from killing the wrong person just because you need to kill somebody.
Right.
That's what worries me about this case. That this is this is about vengeance gone wild.
Well, it is indeed, and it is something that's I'm not sure what will happen as a result of this. If in fact Troy Davis is executed tomorrow, I think there would be repercussions in ways that the establishment really hasn't even considered.
Well, Mike, I have to leave you, and we are certainly not going to have a night like Troy Davis is going to have.
No.
Imagine it being your last night on the planet.
Oh no, God! And at the hands of these people who are intent on believing that you did something that you believe you didn't do. This is there's something so horrific about this that it just kind of begs to be understood.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mike Farrell.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Farrell. He's best known for his 8 years on MASH and 5 seasons on Providence. He's also a writer, director, and producer of the motion pictures such as Patch Adams. He's a social and political activist, president of Death Penalty Focus, and author of Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Dmitry Papadimitriou, who is a highly regarded economist who's worked for the U.S. Congress and Senate. He's the president of the Levy Economics Institute. He's in Greece, so I was able to catch him in Greece, where they are on the precipice of a default, which could unravel the Eurozone. He actually said it was absolutely almost certain that they would default. I asked him when, and he thought it would happen much sooner than people predict, and that the Greek government itself will, you know, try and make this deal over getting an extra $8 billion when they're jumping through hoops just to get the money. But he said by the time the next payment is due, the government will have fallen. So, and he suggested that there'll be a period of economic, not just economic chaos, but political chaos and possible violence in the streets. It is, but on the other hand, he feels that it's actually the situation needs to be clarified, and there's no way that the Greeks can service this mountain of debt. So as bad as it would be, continuing the agony is even worse. So that's, I suppose, a pretty good summary of what he was saying. Then we spoke to an expert on Yemen, Charles Schmidt, about the ceasefire that just took place. But apparently it's a pretty dismal situation where you've got the dictator who's in Saudi Arabia recovering from his wounds, but his sons are back wanting to hold on to power. They've got their Praetorian Guard protecting them. And then there's this general who used to be their chief enforcer, their torturer, who's now the hero of the opposition. He defected with his armed brigades, and they've been slugging it out, and the people have been collateral damage largely. That's what's been going on in the last few days. Apparently the British and the Americans' ambassadors have come up with a ceasefire, but nowhere in this mix seems to be the people of Yemen, even though what's at issue here is whether there'll be elections and who will control the elections. So that's the situation in a country that where we, of course, are more concerned about Al-Qaeda than the fact that this is the poorest nation in the Arabian Peninsula. And then finally, we spoke with activist and actor Mike Farrell about the case of Troy Davis, whose execution is supposed to take place tomorrow, and it seems all but certain. Mike Farrell has been head of Death Penalty Watch Focus for some time. And we talked about the case, and I must say he made a very powerful case against this inhuman act that is about to take place. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.